For more presentations like this, visit www.xenos.org.
My name is Lee Campbell. The topic today is listening and evangelism. Wow. There's so little listening going on. I'm really stunned and pleased you're all here. Listening is super important. You know, I'm going to pray and then we'll get started. Father, thank you for giving us a chance to begin to behave like you do, to be attentive, to pay attention, and to give people the honor and respect of listening to them. Pray this in the name of the one through whom we have access to you, Jesus Christ. Amen. Well, the most obvious part in evangelism, of course, is proclamation. Evangelion means good news. How could you possibly be involved in evangelionism if you weren't actually speaking good news? So sure, proclamation is super important. Similarly, testimony is important. I think this has come up several times. If you want to be involved in evangelism, it's important for you to, in a very succinct way, describe how it is one becomes a Christian, what it is Christ did. Very important. In fact, you could even, there's a cool little book called Share Jesus Without Fear that encourages you to underline a sequence of verses and just have your friend read and interpret for themselves those verses. It's a great approach. It was super helpful for me. But also, testimony is important. The ability to just give someone your own personal experience with God. Testimony may be more helpful for you, but people need to hear how the gospel plays out in real life. So how did you become a Christian? Or how's your relationship with God affecting you this week? Even just ongoing testimonials about God are intriguing and important, and give people a sense of reality about the gospel. But of course, you know, being an evangelist involves more than proclamation or testimonial. We know, we've already heard other people say that it's beautified by our character. And it's beautified by our service to other people. In addition, it's kind of been more hinted at than maybe spoken to directly, but there is something that happens when people come into the presence of groups of Christians. Even groups of Christians that kind of suck a little bit. There is this sense of something's going on here. There is love. And, of course, Christ indicated this is the ultimate testimony about his reality, is that we have love for one another. At our worst, we still exude that mystical sense of having been with God together. Very important. But listening is also critical in evangelism. I became a Christian at 17, and it was outside of the church, but I eventually found my way to a church, and the church decided they wanted to beef up their evangelism, so they brought in a hired gun, an evangelist, and he pulled all the youth, I was 18 at that time, into a meeting, and he taught us a script. You know, this is how you witness, and this is how you, and you need to ask them to pray. And so it was really like a phone solicitor situation. And so I went out in the town that I lived in at the time, and I cornered some guy right in a doorway, and I gave him the gospel. And I could tell I was violating my own conscience, but I still kept pressing to the point that he repeated the words after me and prayed. And I walked away, and I think I effectively inoculated myself and him against the gospel for him and evangelism for me. I didn't really do much evangelism after that. I thought, if this is evangelism, I want nothing to do with it. I went on with my Christian walk. I kind of walked away from God for a while, ended up down here at OSU in graduate school, pursuing a degree in neuroscience, and during that time, I got connected with Xenos, and it was really not like anything I had experienced before. I loved it, and people here in this group were doing evangelism, and once again, there's this ugly situation I'm trying to figure out how to deal with. I don't want to do evangelism. But I found that because of the mind I've been given, because of the things that interested me, like apologetics interested me a lot, I began reading about lots of topics. How do you know God exists? What's the story with evolution? What about the problem of evil? And as I began studying these things, which were of great interest to me, I found that I became an apologist, someone who could sort of argue for. And that usually required that I tag along with someone who was a good icebreaker and could get people to start talking, and I'd be like the lurker, you know, waiting for a question to arise, and I'd be the guy that came in with apologetics. And, you know, it was great. It's great working in teams. Most evangelism should be like that, really. But I found as I encountered people with apologetics that I had this assumption in my mind that because they were raising intellectual issues, that was the problem they were having. And very often what I began to discover was that the people that were resistant to the gospel didn't actually have intellectual problems. Their intellectual arguments were sort of a way to keep people back. There were other reasons that were driving their atheism or their agnosticism or their skepticism. And I wasn't getting at those things with my apologetical approach. It's still important, but I realized it just wasn't, there was something. I was talking to this one guy whose name, oddly enough, was Adam. And as I talked with him, he would raise an argument, and I would respond to his argument, and he would keep score. He'd be like, okay, one for you. And then, you know, okay, one for you. We went and talked to one of our elders one time, came back. I said, how did that go? And he said, he's a really good arguer. And so we kept going. And one day it sort of dawned on me, I think this is the way the Spirit works, that these arguments were having zero effect on him. And I said, Adam, if you knew absolutely for sure that God existed and Jesus Christ died for sin, would you bow the knee? Would you ask him to forgive you? And he's like, nah, God's weird. And I realized at that point, I said, well, you know, this is kind of a waste of time then for us to be talking about this. Now, I tell you, at the time, I don't think I was that alert to the fact that there were other things driving him. I just ended the conversation and I never talked to him again. But something else, I don't know what it is, but something else was really driving his skepticism, not his intellect, because he conceded over and over again these arguments. You keep winning the arguments, but I keep not changing my position. So it was an opportune time for me to shut up and listen, and I didn't. So what I'm hoping to do today is to teach you not to do what I do. Because my career shifted a little bit. I was a professor for 10 years, and then I came on staff here, did various jobs, and then eventually I became a pastoral counselor a few years ago. And I'm gifted probably as a teacher. And what I found out early on as I began, I was about to say teaching because that's exactly what my counseling was like initially, is that I would listen to someone briefly, I'd get kind of a sense of what was going on, and then I'd begin lecturing. And like good students, the people I was counseling with would take out their notepad and start writing furiously. And they're like, oh, this is good stuff. And they'd come back a few weeks later and I would say, so, you know, how did it go? What have you been doing with what we talked about? By which I meant, what have you been doing with the lecture I gave you? And they're like, could you remind me what that was again? And I'm glad this happened early in my pastoral counseling career, because I realized people don't learn by listening to me. They learn by talking. Very important and helpful for me, not only as a pastoral counselor, but also helpful for me as a friend and a father and a husband, at least to some extent. So what I'm going to talk with you about today has a lot of value across the board. In fact, you're surrounded by people you can practice on that are, in fact, probably Christians. And as you practice listening with them, you're going to find you naturally this will spill over into talking with non-Christians as well. So you would sort of have the impression, and it's the right impression, that what I'm trying to accomplish today is to get you to listen to other people. I'm just going to say quickly, listening in evangelism would also include listening to God, right? the Holy Spirit's the primary agent in evangelism, and we have to be able to have one ear tuned in to what the Spirit's leading us as we're also tuned in to what someone is saying. And so listening to God, very important. I think there are people probably in every church that have gifts of faith, and these people tend, you can tell they have gifts of faith because they pray a lot. They're always inviting other people to pray with them. They're always noticing God's doing things, and they're always extolling God for having done things. Get next to people like this because they're going to teach you to get your ear sensitive to what the Holy Spirit's doing in evangelism. But that's not really what I want to talk about today. Also, it's important in listening in evangelism is that you listen to culture. There's nothing worse than assuming the person you're talking with is just like you and has the same assumptions you have and the same background you have, and that's just not true. People have different, they come from different cultures, and the way that they look may tell you nothing about their perspective. We live in a significantly nihilistic culture. Watch any Seth Rogen movie. There's no good, there's no evil, it just is. And you know, The Simpsons and The Family Guy and, you know, Silence of the Lamb, all of these things that actually make the evil person not into an artist. This is nihilism. There's a great little book, I think it's in one of your handouts, that's called Shows About Nothing, written by a philosopher, I think, at Boston University. And he talks about how all of these movies and shows have collectively sort of infiltrated. They both reflect culture, but they also have infiltrated culture to the extent that in culture now, people have just sort of a sense that nothing matters. There's a cynical sense that's settled in on people. And so sometimes you can encounter the cynicism, and it can make you want to walk away or make you push hard. And you need to understand the culture enough to be able to work with people's cynicism, to work with their sense that you are speaking a foreign language when you talk about something like sin. We also have, in my experience, we have people coming to our house church and affiliated with people in our house church from Xi'an, China, that are scholars. And they already have their master's, they already have their PhDs, they're here at OSU as part of an exchange program, uniformly, except for maybe one person, atheist. You know, the word in China used for sin is the word for criminal, so if you talk about everyone being a sinner, that doesn't make any sense. If you don't understand culture, then you're just going to start saying things that make no sense to your audience. You have to be able to listen to culture in order to listen to a person. And a lot of the people we've run into also are modernists. They're naturalists through and through. They're like the U.S. was when I was growing up. Most of the people in academics, in the scientific disciplines anyway, were naturalists. And a lot of these folks are naturalists. And they think the whole idea of God coming in flesh and dying, just, they think it's a mythology. They think it's silly. One guy just said, this is just silly. Now, after a year of spending time with us and enjoying us and being served by us and us enjoying him, he said, there's something here. He said, in China, we have fires like you have here. We sing like you sing around the fire. But there's something here. All we talk about is money and success and the amount of time we're putting in. And it's all, excuse me, bullshit. There's something here that's real, right? And so part of engaging people is understanding their culture enough to sort of bring them into experiences that maybe challenge their assumptions. Listening to culture is important. But the primary thing I want to focus on here today is listening to people. Did we get more copies of the notes in yet? Yeah. Do you not have copies, Melissa? They're cooking. All right. So we'll have to find a way to get them distributed when that happens. All right, so we need to listen to people. You know, God, I think he must assume that we're not that good at this. Otherwise, he wouldn't have stirred James up to say, be quick to hear, slow to speak, slow to anger. And I just think, in my experience, hardly anyone listens. Even, you know, with apologies to my colleagues who are professional listeners, when we get together and talk about what's going on in our pastoral counseling, nobody listens there either. Well, that's maybe an exaggeration, but, you know, it's just when you're in situations that just stimulate you to talk, you feel almost lured into talking when you're with people. They trigger you. They make thoughts come to your mind. And so what I'm going to try and get you to do is slow down and have the discipline, the difficult discipline of concentrating on what someone else is saying. In Proverbs 18:13, we read, if anyone gives an answer before he hears, it is a folly and a shame to him. And I've done this so many times, I will have to admit, my name is Lee, I'm a fool and a shameful person because I'm not a good listener, I haven't been for such a long time. Why do we listen? We listen to represent God. Have you ever noticed, you read through the Bible, and what I notice in the Bible as I read it is that God often asks questions. Doesn't that seem a little weird to you? Why would a being who knows everything ask questions and wait for an answer? It's not to get information. Adam, where are you? Really? He didn't know where Adam was? It's pretty clear shortly he knew exactly where Adam was and he knew what happened. Adam, where are you? Why would he ask a question that he knows the answer to? It must be that Adam needed to speak and Eve needed to speak. And if God, who knows everything, asks questions and waits for a response, how about us, who aren't really omniscient, even though sometimes we feel like we are? Of course we need to do it. If I'm going to represent God, I at least have to have his posture with people, where I'm curious what they think, and I realize, even if I have a sense I know exactly what they're about to say, I don't. And even if I did know exactly what they're going to say, they still need to say it. Ever have anyone finish your sentences? It's only endearing the first once or twice. And then it's just a pain. You know, I've got a few people in my life who finished my sentences, and they'll just finish my sentence, and I'll just keep moving my lips silently. I'm like, why are you doing that? I wanted to finish. It's a drag having someone finish your sentences. It feels, on the one hand, I guess it's flattering someone knows you that well, but on the other hand, it feels like you don't even have to be there. They're having both sides of the dialogue. So we listen to represent God. There's probably more to say about this, but I'm going to move to the next point. We also listen to learn. We're not like God. We have to listen or we don't learn, and again, Proverbs 1:5 says, let the wise hear and gain instruction. Let the discerning acquire guidance. And so discerning is the involvement in reflection, and hearing is the listening. So you listen and you reflect. Oh, they're passing out material, so you might want to get your hand up if you need something. There's an old-fashioned word I like to use for assuming you know what's going on. It's a word called hubris. It's a great term. It's just the idea of arrogance and pride, hubris, presumptuousness. There's hands up in the adjacent room as well. And again, the passage I quoted earlier, Proverbs 18:13, the one who gives an answer before he listens, it's his folly and his shame. You know, the gospel doesn't change But our approach to our audience changes because we learn things about our audience. And now, years ago, my wife and I were talking to our neighbors, and they knew we were Christians. We invited them out. They said no. They said no. And then one day, the neighbor said, could me and my wife study the Bible with you? And I'm like, well, let me think about that. You know, sure. Well, it turns out they were in a marital crisis, and there'd been some infidelity. And the first time we got together, because we'd known them for so many years and spent so much time with them, we were able to quickly move in a certain direction because we had listened and learned over the many years. We really just walked them through a series of verses, like Faye's book, Sharing Jesus Without Fear, and we got to the end. They read the verses, they interpreted the verses, and in the end, we said, so what would keep you from responding to this? Nothing. And they bowed their heads and prayed to receive Christ right then. And so we listen over a long time as neighbors. We learned enough about them that we knew exactly the best approach to use at that moment, which was just to directly get to the gospel. But there wasn't a lot of hope, we said, for your relationship unless you learn how to draw life from God. And this, you first need to get life from God through Christ. Quick. You know, I've talked sometimes to Muslims, and I've found out that my assumptions about what they believe are cartoonish. And I've read books and I've read literature about Islam and the beliefs of Islam. I've read through the Quran, and but you know, I didn't really interact with someone who's Muslim. And one day I was talking with someone, and they said that the Bible's corrupt. And I was taught by someone who came from Islam, just say, may it never be. God's word can never be changed. That's what the Quran says. And so I said, you know, that can't be true. If the Bible is the revealed will of God, then how can it be true that it's corrupted? Is man more powerful than God? This is a great reaction most of the time. But this was a particular Muslim man. It wasn't Islam in general or some particular other Muslim. And he said Christians had their chance. That was the end of the discussion. And I brought up to another Muslim man the idea of the advocacy for violence in the Quran. And he said, doesn't your Old Testament advocate for violence? And I'm like, ibida, ibida, ibida. Right? And so part of listening is that there's things you can learn. There are nuances you can learn about that person and about their beliefs. And there's an integration between what you believe and what they're claiming to believe that you cannot know apart from a genuine, not really a debate style, but a genuine curiosity about what that person believes. Being curious, trying to learn. Letting yourself be a student taught by another person. They don't have to be a scholar in their field to tell you their experience with their beliefs. Right? So you're not comparing what they're saying against what the scholarly book says. You're just trying to understand how did you come to believe what you believe. So we listen to learn. Ephesians 4:15 encourages us to speak the truth in love, which is awesome. But if we don't know what truth they need to hear, how can we do it? This is why we listen. We need to understand what truth applies. Otherwise, we're just going to use truths that are true but useless. One guy calls it witless wisdom. You just need to trust God. True. How? In what particular way? In what way are they not trusting God? Do they realize they're not trusting God in this way? Right? We listen to learn. We also listen to love. I met a young guy in our home group years ago, and he was kind of a pain to be around. He was from a legalistic church background, very opinionated, cantankerous, pugnacious. I kept thinking, why isn't anyone talking with him? I didn't bring him. The people who brought him should talk with him. What's wrong with them? And so I would say, are you ever going to talk with him? And no, they didn't. And so I'm like, this is how I usually do ministry. I first judge everyone else who isn't doing ministry. And then I reluctantly conclude the Spirit was actually encouraging me not to judge, but to go serve. And so eventually I got together with him because he'd said something one time that kind of intrigued me that suggested he had no idea whether he was going to go to heaven or not because he was very legalistic. He came from a legalistic background. And so we got together every week and worked our way through the book of Galatians. And he's probably got ADD. ADHD maybe, because we would be a couple of verses into Galatians and then we'd be talking about this and talking about that, and I would just have to steer wrestle back, okay, now back to this again. And it was murder talking with him, but in the end, we both realized he was not a Christian. He prayed to receive Christ, and he said to me recently, you know, I still remember that time you spent with me, and I felt like you were a real friend to me. We listen to love. People are not listened to. You're not listened to. But I want you to get your head out of that place, because it's a terrible place to live, and concentrate instead on how no one else listens to anyone else either. You ever been around a bunch of middle schoolers? My son and his friends were just a riot to listen to because they're very loud, crude, obnoxious, talking simultaneously, and the winner was the one who could say it the fastest, the funniest, and the crudest. And this continued on into high school, and I contend it continues right on into adulthood, except we get more sophisticated, less crude, maybe less loud, but hardly anyone listens. We listen to love, and we listen so they can listen. Every fight you have ever been in with someone is a fight about who gets to be heard first. I guarantee it. If just one of you in the fight would stop and say to yourself, I've got plenty of time to talk about my part. I've got plenty of time to justify, to contradict, to defend. I've got all the time in the world. I am just going to try to understand what they're saying and try to understand why they feel the way they feel. The fight would go away. And the interesting thing is, as soon as you listen so well, you could make their case for them better than they could make their case for them, something magical happens. They then want to hear your perspective. We listen so they can listen. If we want to preach the good news, then we want to plant the seed in good soil. And sometimes, frankly, the soil is good. The minute we walk up to a complete stranger, the soil's good when we just plant the seed. We give the gospel. But a lot of times we have to do a little work in that garden before the soil is ready. And the work that we do is the work of understanding and loving and making it so easy for them to tell you their perspective on things that they're receptive to what you have to say in response. People are often very confused about their own problems. Where does all that lint come that you find in your belly button? If you have an innie. Maybe you don't have an innie. Mine is a very deep innie. Who knows? But you know, people acquire their beliefs about the world in just sort of a way. They don't actually typically sit down with no beliefs and construct a belief system. There's a mixture of their morality, their immorality, the experiences they've had, the things they come to believe because of their experiences, the things they long for because of the experiences of their life, the things they were exposed to, what everyone else is saying around them, and all together there's this big tangle of lint that is called a worldview. And I don't say it so we can take the posture of superiority, because you're the same way. Years ago, we had a leader in our church who used to go down on campus, and he was like a leprechaun. He was interesting, he was engaging, he was fun. He'd ask people, he could get anyone to talk. And so he would ask people questions like, is there any such thing as evil? And the interesting thing about watching these videos as they poured out is everyone said the same thing using exactly the same words. How does that happen on a university campus with all the free thought that's there, all the variety of different positions? It's monolithic. There's not a variety of positions. And many people have strongly held beliefs that they've never given a thought to. They've just accumulated them. And unless you let people talk, they often haven't even thought about these things themselves. Half of you have never thought about anything unless your mouth was open. And I'm not saying that derogatorily, it's how you're built. You think out loud. But if your friend is one of those people that needs to think out loud, why wouldn't you afford them the opportunity to think out loud? We had a professor of philosophy down here one time who described an encounter he had with a student who had, you would think a philosopher would just be trying to angle you like a chess master into a corner so he could pop you with truth. But this guy wasn't like that. He was just genuinely curious how people come to believe what they come to believe. And so this guy believed in crystals and auras and aliens and all sorts of New Agey kinds of things. And so he was trying to explain how, and he would just ask, how's this related to that? How do these two things connect? And the guy was getting frustrated, so he handed a piece of paper and a pen, and he started writing and drawing arrows from one thing to the other, and he just kept asking more questions. And finally, the guy threw down the pen and says, this makes no sense. But he had probably pontificated over many beers and many doobies and many cigarettes about these things for a really long time, but he'd never been listened to long enough for him to recognize his thinking was confused. All it took was someone being willing to listen for him to hear himself. Right? We listen so people can listen. Part of you guys are, you don't need to have your mouth open to think, you're thinking constantly. But your thinking gets very weird. You know, you withdraw with a few ideas in your little thinking cave, and you start putting them together, and you come up with this Quasimodo sort of synthesis of how the world is, and you haven't talked with anyone, but you're sure it's true. Some of the people you're trying to listen to are like, I'm like that, by the way. And so I have to, as a guy like that, frankly, I have to be able to come to people and say, let me tell you what crazy thing I've been thinking lately. And they're like, yeah, that's crazy. But until I learned the importance of opening my mouth and talking, I didn't realize how important it was for my ability to think things through, to get outside input. And so your friend may not have this insight, but by providing that listening environment, you're providing them with outside input, with your questions and your interests. All right. So let's spend a little time looking at how to listen. And this is not going to be a full-blown lecture experience, because I'm going to take time throughout to break you up into duets and have you practice some of these techniques. So I'm going through the hows, and then we're going to stop and practice some of the hows. So I'm hoping by the time we get out of here, you'll at least have tried this long enough to practice some of these things. How to listen. Listening is strenuous activity. And for some of you, it's strenuous activity because you spend all of your time thinking about how to respond. And I'm just asking you, in your heart of hearts, to say, I do not have to respond. My job is simple. My job is to listen and make it easy for them to say what they're thinking. That's all I have to do. I've got plenty of time to mull over what they said and swing back around and talk with them this night or some other day. I've got plenty of time. Job one for me, early on especially in evangelism, is to listen. Make it easy for them to talk. So I think it's important to be spiritually minded or you can't listen. What do I mean by that? Well, if you don't really have a deep held belief that the Holy Spirit was talking to them before you ever showed up, convicting them of things before you ever showed up, the Spirit is in this situation. He brought this situation together, and the Spirit will be involved long after you're there. Then you're going to be anxious, like you've got to do something. You've got to provide an answer. You have to provide a response. People get the same kind of anxiety at funerals. Like they don't know what to say, and so they say the dumbest thing you could possibly imagine. And the list is long. You don't have to feel that pressure to give an answer. You can't even listen if you feel that pressure. You've got to understand this is God's field. This is His work. He may grab you and on a bolt with you, but you are a means to His end of accomplishing His purpose of reconciling the lost world to Himself. You are not the boss of the situation. You're the employee. Relax. It's very relaxing when you realize that. So your job is not really complex. You just say, my job is to make it easy for them to fully express their perspective. That's my job. Now, it's not always your job. There are times when you have to speak or you have to give a testimony or other, you know, you have to serve in some of these other things you may have to do, but that's not what this seminar is about. Most of the time, your job is to make it easy for them to express their perspective. Second, pay attention to nonverbal communication. Theirs and yours. This is something people who are in their head trying to think of a response will not do. Do you ever ask someone a question? Let me ask you a question. How many traffic lights did you come through today when you're on your way here? No idea. Okay, let me ask a question. What's the loudest sound you heard this morning?
Car horn.
What you can't tell, I'm going to have to just tell you about, was that each of their eyes shifted in a certain direction when I asked them this question. His eyes shifted down when I was asking, and they shifted a little bit toward his left side, and her eyes shifted up and to the right. When people are thinking, their eyes shift to different locations because they're processing things. Pay attention to what people's eyes are doing. Don't look at their eyes shifting away as an opportunity to start blathering. They're gathering their thoughts. Don't make it hard for them to gather their thoughts. You know, you're like the guy, like my, you know, this kid I was picking strawberries with came by and hit my basket and dumped strawberries everywhere. That's like you, because you're interrupting. You're not paying attention. Watch. You know, notice their breathing. Notice their emotions. You know, the chin is a great indicator of sadness. People, when they're sad, this gets tight. Notice it. Notice their lips. Notice how they're posing. Just, you know, and frankly, this is another tip. Notice, and sometimes it's important to notice it out loud. To say, it seems like you're having trouble making eye contact. Is there something on your mind? You seem angry. So, I mean, this seems like a stupid example, but one time I was talking with this guy, and a couple of my friends were talking to this guy about Christ, and the idea of that God, that Jesus is the only way to God, really was offensive to him, and he jumped up and he said, God damn you, and God damn you, and God damn you! And the guy was so funny and charming, it was really hard to take it to heart. But you know, someone had the wherewithal to say, why does this make you so angry? Right? They just know, I mean, it was That wasn't really hard to pick up on the anger. Doesn't require a lot of subtlety there, but just to notice the anger and ask a question about it. And you sometimes you just have to notice what people seem to be feeling, but don't assume you know what they're feeling. Just say, it seems like, is this true? So if part of noticing is that it helps you to adjust, but it's not going to help you adjust if you assume you know what it means. You have to ask. This is magic, by the way. I've got two pieces of magic for you. One piece of magic is this. I want you to repeat after me. Say what you see. Yeah, good. My work here is done. I'll bring this up a little later, but it's important to notice body language, and not every single time. It's irritating to feel that scrutinized, but at times it's reasonable to say what you see. No one wants to be that scrutinized. It's creepy, actually. But pay attention. Pay attention to your own body language. You know, I really admire people who have the ability to take pens and flip them. You know, those little sort of acrobatic things they're doing sometimes with two hands, and very amazing. You know how hard it is to talk to someone when they're doing that? If you like to tap and wiggle your toes and look around and clear your throat and things like that, notice that it may be really distracting and maybe you need to stop. And, you know, it's really not hard to square up to someone. That means to fully face them, to lean forward, to be warm and receptive, and to nod your head. It invites people to disclose things. Your silence is inviting as well. Talk about that again in a little bit. Head nodding, appropriate facial gestures. Sometimes if people aren't used to being good listeners, they're creepy initially because their smile is pasted on and their stare is like a baboon in a cage. You know, frightening, really. But if you're not used to being a good listener, you're not naturally warm, you know, I'm not naturally warm, then you have to practice until it's not creepy and weird. Practice with a friend. You know, have them put up their creepometer or something. You know, I realized a few years back, I thought I was a warm person, and then I was recording my voice for an answering machine. And it was sort of like, wow, I thought I was really warm, but it was really flat. So I slid forward on the chair, and I put a little more effort into it. It was like, so I finally stood up and I threw all my, I felt like a complete clown, and it got slightly warm. So some of you, you know, you may feel like I'm, you know, I got my photograph taken for my license. And so I'm thinking, okay, I want to have like an appealing, you know, picture, you know, so I, you know, I'm there and I kind of tilt my head. I look like a freaking serial killer. If I ever get pulled over, I'm going to be in handcuffs just based on that picture. We don't really know how we come off sometimes. So it's just, you know, give people permission who know you well, just to, you know, give me feedback. I want to try to be a good listener, and maybe I've got tics, or maybe I've got ways of responding that are hard to read. Some of you are so stoic, you'd be great on the World Tournament of Poker, but that's not that great when you're trying to talk. All right, so get some input. Also, you know, an occasional, you know, just not words, but sounds that you're not throwing in randomly, but they're actually coming out of your soul because you're actually interested, engaged, or moved. Now, how many of you get really uncomfortable in silence? Yeah. Silence is really important in conversation. It's if we really believe God's involved, silence is often when the Holy Spirit's doing things. silence gives them a chance to gather their thoughts. And silence also might make them a little uncomfortable. But a lot of times into that discomfort, they'll disclose things. One guy, Henri Nouwen, puts it this way in his book, The Way of the Heart. We become so contaminated by our wordy world that we hold to the deceptive opinion that our words are more important than our silence. So, you know, if you are really uncomfortable in a moment where it's silent, say what you see. Say what you're feeling. Just say, I always feel uncomfortable in silence, but I find it helps me to organize my thoughts. Do you find that? You're just being open. A best example I can think of in my life of just saying what you're thinking, not just what you're seeing, but what you're thinking, is I had a neighbor I'd been inviting out to our Bible study. And he seemed interested. His wife seemed interested, but they kept not coming. And so I was headed over there to borrow back some tools that he borrowed, and my wife, as I'm leaving the front door, says, make sure you ask them to come to Central Teaching. I'm like, no, I don't want to do that. And I said, I got to the point finally in my marriage, I actually start feeding back verbally these things. And I said, I'm really reluctant to do that. I didn't do it in the baby way. And she said, why? And I'm like, they're telling us with their feet they're not interested. See what I did? I made an observation. I invite, they didn't come, and I drew a conclusion, they're not interested. Mistake. And so I went over there, he wasn't home, so I came back home feeling so fortunate I didn't have to invite him again. And I was telling my office mate the other day so I'd get some sympathy from him about my wife's demand that I do this really uncomfortable thing, and he's like, do you think that they would enjoy it? I'm like, yeah, I think they really would enjoy it. Why are you reluctant to ask? You know, see what he's doing? He's freaking listening. And listening, he's helping me draw out my own thoughts. I said, well, I don't want to pester him. He said, why don't you just tell them those two things? You don't want to pester them, but you think they'd like it. Now I've got it coming at me in stereo. So the next night I trudge over there, knock on the door. Hey, Mike, I need my pipe wrenches. And so I'm about to leave with them, and I'm like, okay, here we go. I said, so I was going to invite you guys out to our Bible study again, but I'm fearful that I'm pestering you. And the wife said, oh, you're not pestering us. And I'm sorry that my women's voices sound so weird. They all sound like Marge Simpson. I don't actually hear women's voices that way. I just can't do them very well. But he said something interesting. He said, well, what would I have to wear? And what goes on there? My conclusion was dead wrong. He didn't want to walk into a situation that would make him feel uncomfortable and awkward. And by just saying what I was thinking, I invited him to say what he was thinking. And they came out and eventually both became Christians. Isn't that amazing? Say what you're thinking. All right, so exercise one. Now this is going to be challenging, and I'm going to have to rely on some discipline on your part. This is the discipline I'm going to have to rely on because I want to set this up, and then I'll let you do this thing that requires discipline. And then we're going to do the exercise. It's going to be about a 5-minute exercise. Okay. I want you to take turns, about 2 to 3 minutes each. We're going to pair you up. Tell what your highest or lowest low has been over the past few weeks and why. And the listener is not to speak. The listener is not to speak. Practice body language that encourages disclosure, right? Squaring up, leaning toward, smiling, nodding your head. And notice their body language. Practice noticing their body language. And then in about 2 minutes, 2.5 minutes, then flip. And the other person takes their turn. And I want you to pay attention to what you learn about yourself in both situations as the speaker or the listener, and this is the discipline. I'm going to have you count off 1, 2, 1, 2, 1, 2, 1, 2, all the way back there. In fact, I'll start you, and we're just going to work our way like this, and all the ones and the twos pair up and start talking. I'm going to get you guys started, and once you get your numbers, then pair up and start talking.
Go.
So, one. Oh, you want to be one? One, two, one. Work your way back. Oh, well, free for all. Talk to whoever you want to. Or you could switch. So what's the highest high, the lowest low, and why? So the paper asks that question. Switch. Thank you. In the interest of time, I'm drawing it to a close. Just I'd like to hear from a couple of you. As the listener, what did you discover about yourself?
I had the deepest impulse to speak as soon as I thought something. It had to come out, and it was so hard to hold it back because I didn't realize how strong an impulse it was.
What's your name?
Jackson.
Say?
Jackson.
So I want you to say, hi, I'm Jackson. I'm a terrible listener. Okay. Anyone else? You took it away. Yeah. 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 So some of us are trying to fix. Is that you, Jackson? Some of us are just take the conversation away from the person who's talking, and suddenly we're talking about ourselves. Maybe don't even realize that's happened. As the listener, I'm switching horses. What did it feel like to have someone not talk while you were talking?
It actually really helped me to be able to figure out all of my thoughts because I was given the time to speak. In my week, because my week's been really busy, I didn't really think about anything that I did last week. So thinking about it and actually being able to share something important was a really cool opportunity.
Huh. So did some emotions come up that...
Yeah, I noticed when I'm talking about things that are important, my last week has been pretty, I guess, jam-packed. I got a new job, so realizing all this stuff, things that are kind of important or vulnerable for me to talk about, I tend to divert eye contact. And I noticed the same thing with her too. When we're talking about something important, we don't really lock eyes with each other.
Uh-huh. It's kind of It feels really vulnerable. Yeah, and actually looking at someone, you're being vulnerable is tough. Yeah. That's kind of normal. That's not abnormal. Yes, sir?
I think for me, it's it was weird because I wanted to pause because I felt in normal conversations, you talk and someone else jumps in with something, and then, it's weird because I had all this time to just keep talking about whatever.
What was that like for you to be able to have all that time? Yeah.
Yeah.
Huh. What a gift to listen. Yes, sir?
I'm Mike. I'm a terrible listener.
I'm sorry, what?
I'm Mike. I'm a terrible listener.
Okay.
It was hard for me to not want to ask more questions.
Yeah.
Tell me more about that. Or along something like that. Wow, that must have been hard.
Uh-huh. Yeah. You were listening. Well, truthfully, it is good to empathize and to give feedback and ask questions and ask further questions. Sometimes the questions are coming so rapidly from you, you realize that you aren't actually... Sometimes I've asked a question in the middle of someone talking, which indicates to me I'm not listening. Okay, one more and then we're going
to
move on. It takes a lot of discipline to listen. I think one thing you can sort of rely on God, this is part of being spiritually minded, is just to ask the Spirit to help you remember things that are relevant that you need to bring up later. It'll come back to mind. He'll help. Because our time is winding down, I'm going to try and move through some of this stuff quickly because I want to get to the last how to ask questions piece. To be non-judgmental and empathetic, this basically means that you don't feel like you have to respond to every theologically incorrect thing they say. A lot of us are are so into fixing things. If someone tells us how they feel, we tell them they shouldn't feel that way. Come on, really? If they tell us what they think, we correct their thinking. If they tell us what they want, we correct their wants. And we have to delay this impulse to correct and fix. This is what I mean by being non-judgmental and empathetic. I don't mean that everything they say is right, or what they say about their feelings is legit, or that their thoughts are accurate, or that their desires are even placed right. But in withholding and suspending the right to intervene, you invite them to say more. And you actually increase the receptivity to the feedback you might give them. If someone says to you, I'm never going to believe this crap, it's stupid. You could go into a little mini lecture about the dangers of rejecting God, and you would be correct, but it might not really help the conversation that much. To be able to say to them, in light of what we've talked about here, it makes sense to me that this would feel stupid to you. I get why this feels stupid. You might be surprised that they're like, so why doesn't it feel stupid to you? And then you can give your perspective. I had an exercise for you. Try this with a friend or a significant other in your life. This exercise is trying to get someone to talk about a time that they doubted God, or if they're actively doubting God, say a non-Christian friend, or are disappointed in God, and try to keep yourself from correcting their feelings, their thoughts, even if they're trying to justify behaviors. Don't resist the impulse to make them not justify their behaviors. Just keep asking, keep inquiring, make it easy for them to talk. Checking for understanding is super important. This is when you've listened for a while, and then you say, so it sounds to me like you said this, and then you repeat your understanding of what they've said. And that's called check for understanding, because it presumes you're not necessarily right. A lot of us don't check for understanding, and we begin interacting with someone as if what we concluded is correct. And that's not that good. It's important to check, to ask. Daniel Dennett, the atheist philosopher, says something I think is really helpful about debating. He says you should attempt to re-express their position so clearly and vividly and fairly that they say, thanks, I wish I'd have thought of putting it that way. A lot of times when we summarize what we've heard someone say, we either deliberately, because we're arrogant, or not deliberately, but we're just not listening very well, feedback or summarize what we've heard in such a cartoon form that it's easy to reject and knock down. And that's really disrespectful. No one likes to have their perspective portrayed as cartoonish, and especially because it's meaningful to them. And so to feedback in a way that is really fair and fairly represents, so much so that they could say to you, thanks, I don't think I could have put it together that well myself. Thank you. That is good listening and good feedback on your listening. And frankly, you should let them know at the points at which you agree with them. You know, it is bizarre to me when I see a child dying in front of my eyes, it's hard for me to understand what God's up to. It's hard. It's hard to face the effects of the fall and wonder why God isn't doing anything about it. I totally, completely get it. And also thank them for that. If you are really a good listener, you're going to learn a lot about them, and you're maybe going to learn a lot about a perspective you haven't understood that well. Not just their personal perspective, but the concepts they're bringing out, and for you to say, you know, this is really helpful. I had no idea this is what Mormons believed. You know, you're not arguing against a book when you're talking to this person, so you can't bring up what you read in a book or what you read in the Book of Mormon if they've never read the Book of Mormon. You're interacting with a person who's come up with conclusions about what Mormonism teaches. And for you to listen well enough to feedback what you've heard and say, that's not what the Book of Mormon teaches, dude. But to say, thanks. I didn't realize that you believed that before, or I didn't realize that nuance was in there. And to say thank you is a sign of a good listener. And this is the second piece of magic. What's the first piece of magic? Say what you see and what you're thinking. Not, all the time, but enough that it allows them to see you and to see through your eyes what you're noticing. But the second piece of magic is validation. Validation is when you've summarized what someone has said, and once you've summarized it, you can say to them, this makes sense to me. Not you're right to feel this way, you're right to think this, but I understand why you would feel this way. I understand why you might think this. I was talking to my wife and said, hey, Maurice is studying Galatians with his nephew. And she said, racist? And I said, racist? And she said, you said racist. I didn't say racist. I said, Maurice is. Now we're, yes, you did. No, you didn't. Yes, you did. No, you didn't. And I'm like, I said, there's no reason for me to say racist. Maurice is black. I wasn't saying racist. So I'm arguing my case. And she said, but don't you understand how I would have heard racist? I'm like, I don't really care why you would have heard racist. But when she said, don't you understand why, I realized she's asking for validation. This is a stupid example, but, I said, I totally get why you would have thought I said racist, because Maurice sounds like racist when it comes out of my mouth. Makes sense. And then we could talk about Maurice having a Bible study with his nephew. But this happens in so many arguments where the person wants to know that they're not stupid, that you get why they feel the way they feel, even if you don't agree with the way they feel. This is magic. Saying what you see, validating what you have heard, magic. It will really transform all of your conversations. And then ask good questions. I put this off last because questions are super important, but they're often a substitute for listening. And I wanted to try and make the case for listening before I made the case for asking questions. There's a handout you have that has two illustrations on it. One, I think the first page has an illustration called Going Deeper. I want you to flip that out of the way because what I wanted to look at first was this thing called the Johari Window. This is a model, a concept put together by two psychologists, Joseph Luft and Harrington Ingham. And you can see they just took the first couple of letters from each of their first name, and that's where the word Johari came from, Joseph and Harrington. And they describe people as having these four kind of quadrants to themselves, and that is that there's a part of them that's open. That is, you as their friend knows certain things about them, and they also know these things about themselves. This is an area called the open self. And they would argue, and counselors argue, that health and maturity is enlarging this open area. And so then there's to the right is this quadrant called the blind spot, things that others know that that person does not know. That's their blind spot, right? How do you push the wall in such a way that the blind spot area gets smaller? As a friend who's talking to someone, how do you embiggify the open area when that person doesn't know what they don't know? You say what you see. And saying what you see and feeding back what you're hearing and telling them what your thoughts are, you're enlarging this, you're shrinking the area of the blind spot. There's this other quadrant called the hidden area. These are things that I know about myself but you don't know, either because I've deliberately hidden them from you or you haven't known me long enough to know these things. Or I don't trust you enough to tell you these things. How do we shrink the hidden area? Being good listeners. Being silent. Noticing, asking questions, watching their reactions, asking questions about their reactions. Create an environment where we're not judging, but we're empathizing. Gives them kind of a sense that they can go ahead and reveal more. Like someone said, I felt really nervous, to share, because I've never had anyone listen before, and I wasn't sure, do I have anything to share at all? Right? Giving people that sense of acceptance and warmth, and you're going to hesitate to feed back anything negative, and wait, will enlarge that area. What about this unknown area? These are things you don't know about them, and they don't even know about themselves. You know, everybody here is driven by things that you don't really understand that well yourself. They formed really early in your life, and they come from areas that I like to call, or other people that I know like to call, core beliefs and core desires. And these core beliefs, these core desires are forged so early in life and overlaid with an adult perspective on our early life to such an extent that even though they drive us, we're barely aware of them. Why are you spending so much time at the health food store? Why are you getting all these vitamins? Why are you obsessed with every article about health and all of this and that? Where's this coming from? Well, it's, you need to take charge of your own health. A lot of our weirdest behaviors come from this core that we don't even understand. Why does someone have this need to control their situation? Where did they get the impression the world is out of control? That often comes early on in life. Where do they get the impression that they're undesirable? Came early in life. You discover these things. If you flip back to this first page, there's a diagram I like to use in counseling. I use it, I have it in my head in every conversation. It helps me ask good questions. People will tell you stuff that they've seen, they've heard, they've remembered, they've experienced. It's triggered something. They're telling you for some reason. And they'll often tell you something. They'll tell you what they did, or they'll tell you how they felt, or they'll tell you what they wanted out of the situation, or they'll tell you what their thoughts were. Wherever they start, your questions are to get them to more fully expand on the experience. If they tell you what they did, you could ask them, how did you feel when you did that? How did you feel before you did it? How did you feel after you did it? What were you thinking that you felt that way and did that thing? What is it you wanted in this situation that you were thinking this and feeling this and doing that? What did you do when you were feeling this? These are simple questions that's allowing them to more fully express. Some of you have said, I'm not used to being listened to. Maybe I'm not that interesting. You're very interesting. But you're maybe not used to thinking very broadly about what's going on in your heart and mind. And a good listener will make it easy for you to move into areas. If my wife says, how was your day? I'm like, okay. Right? I don't have very quick access to how I feel about things or my thoughts about things. If she were content with that, you say, okay, cool, let me tell you about my day. And I actually can, I'm better at moving toward that stuff with her than I am moving toward that in myself. It takes a good listener to give you time. When I first was married to my wife, I would come home and she'd be banging around in the kitchen and I'd be like, what's going on? I don't know. You seem angry. You're angry? I don't know. What happened today? Well, this happened. Is that making you angry? No. And eventually, I'd mention something and she would start crying, typically. and then she would begin talking. Now, 30 years later, she does this automatically. I don't have to do this anymore. But this is just a lifetime of learning to explore what someone's thinking, feeling, desiring, and doing. On the flip side of this, I have something I actually think is super important, but I've run out of time. And that is that there are challenges as a listener, and there are challenges as a speaker, that you do more than just tell people what you see, or they do more than just tell you what they see. They interpret it. And that makes it harder for them to understand because they see, they interpret. And you have to resist as the listener biting on their conclusions and fighting with them about the wrongness of their conclusions. They have a feeling and blame someone for it. You need to resist the temptation to tell them to not feel that way or that they're wrong to feel that way. So I'm just going to have to commend this to you to read because we're out of time. I'm going to stop now. I think you've got plenty of people in your life you can practice on that are Christians and non-Christians, and I'm just going to ask you to practice.
This study was recorded at Xenos Christian Fellowship and is copyrighted. You may freely copy and distribute it as long as you keep it intact and do not sell it.